The first case today is number 261187, United States versus Yaron Vizcaino. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please introduce herself on the record to begin?
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Chrissy DeMasso. I represent Yaron Vizcaino. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you. Mr. Vizcaino is entitled to a two-level role reduction under both 3B1.2 as well as 2D1.1E2B. The government acknowledges that he was among the people with the lowest level function described in the indictment. Specifically, he delivered drugs in user-level quantities at the direction and under the control of a large hierarchical drug trafficking organization. He did not understand the scope of the organization, did not plan or organize the criminal activity, had no decision-making role in the criminal activity, and had no discretion in performing his own role. He had no criminal history. He did this work to support his family, including his young children, and was paid a small amount, but did not otherwise profit from the enterprise. The district court did not perform the proper analysis with respect to either provision, and thus abused its discretion.
Counsel, let me ask you, because you mentioned that the government acknowledged that he was less culpable, and specifically, I know you point out in your brief, when the government recognized there's an argument that Vizcaino is distinguishable as less culpable than Ms. Abel Rivera, and then also there's another statement by the government that it's a good argument that he's a minor or lower participant. How much weight should the court, or didn't the court, give to that? Because that, again, that's the government's opinion, but is the government in a better position to inform the court than perhaps a pre-sentence report, or, you know, the court makes its own determination?
I think here that the court didn't do the proper steps to make the proper determination. And I think that the place I would point to in the brief where I'm talking about the lowest level is Government Brief 23, where they sort of say he's among the lowest level. You know, Mr. Vizcaino argues he's among the lowest level. That probably weighs in his favor, but there's sort of other things. And I think if we...
So let's break this apart.
Yep.
Two separate things going on here with 3B1.2. Mm-hmm. And then 2D1.1. So which one are you leading with?
I mean, I think that in this particular case, 2D1.1 can sort of come in to save any problems with the,
that's the idea,
3B1.2 right? Argument.
1.1 is a recognition that 3B1.2 is a very complicated analysis that may not help your person, but maybe 2D1.1 is. Is that the sort of your lead position?
Yes. I mean, it's sort of, I found it easier analytically to think about 3B1.2 first, simply because it's sort of in place and gives like the sort of recognized framework now, and then 2D1.1 gets even bigger. And 2D1.1, you know, the commentary makes it very clear that some of the problems that are here, if this court were to think that some of those problems bar Mr. Vizcaino from getting relief, that 2D1.1 is specifically meant to address those.
I mean, so just there's a lot going on in this case.
Yes.
So, presentation-wise, I thought the 3B1.2 presentation of the defendant in the district court was relatively weak. So in the pleading, the sentencing memorandum, there's like a paragraph with no analysis of 3B1.2. And then there's a thorough analysis of 2D1.1. Judge Casper talks a little about 3B1.2, but there's not like a full-on unraveling of all the factors. And there really was no objection by the defense of how she went about that. So I wonder first if the 3B1.2 piece is forfeit, and that the focus really should be on 2D1.1. What's your reaction to that?
First, I'll answer the preservation. I think the case I would really look to show that this is preserved, the most on-point case is Robles-Lopez. I think you had a similar situation there where the PSR is laying out why they think that the reduction applies. Right. So the PSR here is sort of parroting the kind of fourth factor from the five-factor test. And initially, Mr. Vizcaino is saying, oh, we should actually get 4 points off. And he then agrees, well, two is more appropriate. But so he's agreeing with this sort of proposition, right? That the fourth factor, maybe that's where there's some discussion and some play, because that's about Mr. Vizcaino's role himself. And the PSR is saying he didn't have any discretion performing this role. He's doing everything at the direction of the drug trafficking organization. The government objects to that. And their arguments to that are sort of a little bit off kilter, right? They're sort of this essential role, this number of participants. They're sort of not really about the rooted in these five factors and the four-part test. And then the court, it's a very terse explanation, but sort of follows that. But I think the fact that counsel you know, is saying the PSR has it right. That is alerting the court that that's the proper analysis. Everyone knows sort of in the background what the proper analysis is. It's just nobody is really focusing on it. But I do think that if there is a preservation problem, or even if this court wanted to say we don't, you know, have an opinion that there's a preservation problem, I do think 2D1.1 fixes that.
Counsel, what do you think the district court, if you had to just encapsulate it in one sentence, what do you think the district court got wrong under the 2D1.1 analysis?
I think there's two, I think that there are two legal interpretations that the district court makes that are simply incorrect. The district court talks about user quantity meaning user quantity and therefore would bar people who ever possessed more than a single user quantity. And then the district court says, and I read both of these as interpretation, and the language that it uses is quite clear, like my interpretation of 2D is this. The other piece is that the court says that this is for people who fell or were pushed into the role. So I think, you know, where we're looking at 2D1.1 is it's meant to be an expansion. It's meant to be bringing more people into the fold. Presumably people who had a single, only ever possessed a single user quantity and who fell or were pushed into the role or, you know, were somehow forced, presumably those people were already getting role reductions. And if those two pieces, either one of those two, it doesn't even have to be both, if either one of those is correct, then 2D1.1 is really not going to do the work that the commission is.
Ms. Damaso, it seems to me that what we're trying to do here is identify certain people that the judge thinks are lower level sort of drug distributors. And you can look at, I mean, we can look at this person, it seems to me, through a few different lenses. You offer one, which is user quantities. Another way to like present this person is every day from 7 o'clock in the morning or whatever to sometime at night, they are in their car getting drug orders. They are delivering. They go back. They wait for the next order. They're doing that day, hour after hour, all day long, distributing lots of drugs. They're being paid for it. And that's another way to look at this person. And the judge has to sort of make it seems like this is a mixed question of applying sort of these different versions of facts to whatever this language is. And don't we give some deference to the judges doing that? And it seems to me she looked at him more the way I described and the way you described. Both might be right, but in the end, these seem like the judge has to make this call and it wasn't unreasonable.
I do think when you look at what the judge said, that she is making these two sort of legal determinations that are simply wrong about what is true of this. And it's on addendum 11 and 12 are really the first one is actually on addendum 10. And then that's the one about what user level quantity means.
I did want to ask you about that because when I read addendum 10, it seems that what the district court was saying was the two errors that you've identified, she actually thought it was critical to read that language together. And it seemed to me, based on what she says on 10, that it's because of her interpretation of I have to read everything together that she decides your client doesn't qualify. So she says, low-level trafficking functions, user level, and then something other than motivated by profit. I mean, to the extent that those things are grouped together, I think a reasonable reading is X. So I'm just curious, is there anything, I know you're out of time, but have we seen any interpretation from other courts about, you know, obviously we generally read language together, you know, what does it mean when you put these two things together about what really the commission had in mind here?
I mean, 2D1.1 is very new. I do think that he actually, when you look at all of the criteria, like he doesn't have to meet everything laid out in 2D1.1, right? Most of it is examples. But I think he meets all of them. And I think that even if you view this as, you know, every day there is someone in this car going out and delivering these things, that still, like, that's how a sort of hierarchical, not just a drug trafficking organization, but, you know, something like DoorDash, that's how they work. And so the fact that this role is a key part of their...
It could also be the person who is either once or a few times or periodically or is a girlfriend who's asked by the, you know, there are all different permutations of this. So how do we decide where to draw that line between somebody who lower level in this organization, but is, you know, working as a drug distributor every day for a significant amount of time every day. And so how do we decide when it's right or wrong for the judge to sort of draw that line?
Well, we don't have him working every day. We have specific instances that they've got on the wiretap, and it's over a two-month period. And you know, you see him being replaced, like somebody else gets arrested in the same car a month later. I think that the key here is that the judge was not using the right standards to draw that line, and the commentary, not application notes. You know, the commentary to 2D1.1 is really clear that when you have a case where there's these problems with 3B1.2 that may arise with sort of numbers of people and are there a lot of people doing this lower level function, that that's who this is meant to be for. And for that expansion to be meaningful, the limits that the court put on it are wrong, and someone like Mr. Vizcaíno really does merit the reduction.
Do you frame it as a de novo legal error in the interpretation of the language, or do you determine it as some kind of abuse of discretion in how the facts were applied to the language of 2D1.1?
I think you could do either here. I do think that there are two separate legal interpretations that are incorrect here. But I also think that you can sort of look at 2D1.1 overall and say that this was an abuse of discretion, that she didn't sort of do the right test, do it thoroughly enough. I mean, there's very limited explanation on both standards.
She did it thoroughly enough, but she said, I did consider 2D1.1. Isn't that enough? Because she's telling everybody, I go, the government raises that in its brief. I am considering that. That's not enough, or you need to go kind of one by one, or maybe speak out a little bit more.
I don't think there's enough on either. And I think that, you know, to go back to 3B1.2 for a minute, but it all comes together that in a lot of this court's recent 3B1.2 cases, you see this court saying, you know, you need to tell us more. You need to like not just say how the factors apply to this individual, but you need to say how they apply comparatively. And if something like that is required for 3B1.2, I don't see it here. I don't see the factors coming through. I don't see the pieces where this court could infer what the district
defense
court
counsel, just to
doing.
Be clear, said nothing about that when the district court said, I've considered the factors. There is nothing, right? We agree on that. I mean, it feels like none of the 2D1, I agree, is completely joined. I guess I'm still struggling with how you think the 3B1.2, which was really joined here.
I think, you know, agreeing with the PSR, which is clearly citing these five factors and citing the standard, that is what triggers the court's requirement to do the analysis correctly. You know, it's just the court has to do it right. And if the court doesn't do it right, and defense counsel has sort of asked for it, which defense counsel did, right? Defense counsel said, we need to do 3B1.2 and 2D1.1, that's enough to trigger the requirement. The court knew, because, you know, as we were just talking, you know, the court says over and over again, I know I'm doing 3B1.2. I know I'm doing 2.1, 2D1.1. That is enough. Yeah, sorry for stumbling over my numbers, but that is enough to trigger that the court knew what was going on. That's what preservation is for. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the United States please introduce herself on the record to begin?
Good morning, may it please the court. Karen Eisenstadt for the government. Unless the court has a different preference, I wanted to say one thing about preservation as to 3B1.2 and then turn to the new special instruction. So the government's contention that the claim is not preserved is essentially because his argument on appeal is totally focused on identifying the average participant. Who's the average participant? Did the court interpret that correctly? Nowhere below did he say anything about average participant. The PSR didn't use that term. He didn't use the term.
That's in the sentencing memorandum. There's no explanation for it, but it does say we think this he is substantially less culpable than the average participant.
Well, I think other than just echoing the test, they said, well, the PSR identified him as one of the lowest level people. It doesn't say the government has said the average participant are the drivers. This is his burden on this reduction. The government identified its view of the average participant as the drivers, and he at no point challenged that, and instead at the sentencing, after the government said, that's our view of the case, so he's not substantially less culpable than the average, he said, I don't necessarily disagree with anything the government said, and that was the extent of his argument. So that's the government's view on preservation, is simply that if the claim is the universe of participants is wrong, for example, I think in the recent Conseil level case, then you need to say something about who's in the universe and, you know, are you counting everyone? If your claim is essentially who's the average participant, and it's a reduction on which you have the burden, and the government's put out a position of this is the average participant, you at least need to say, I don't think the government's right. That's not the average participant. He just sort of talks past and says, well, the PSR says I'm, you know, one of the lower level guys in this organization, which has nothing to do with identifying the average participant and applying it.
Even following up on Judge Aframe's question, when there was sort of some objection to the PSR, not to the PSR, but below, but then after the government speaks, then defense counsel says, well, I can't really argue against that. He's sort of like waiving that argument, or he's now stopped because he's changed arguments. Because I've seen, there are some cases that when you change your argument or agree to something, then you can't later disagree. Is that what sort of happened?
I mean, I think it's close to a waiver. The government didn't argue it's a waiver because he just said, I don't necessarily disagree, but didn't say, you know, I concede or I withdraw or anything like that. But coupled with the fact that he's just never challenged who the average participant would be, and that's the gist of his entire appellate claim, I don't see how he could have preserved that because he never told the district court, the government keeps telling you the average participant are these people, and that's wrong. Like, he just never said anything about the concept at all.
Before you move on from that, can I just ask how you would do that analysis? So I see two different ways to do the average participant analysis. One would be there were a lot of drivers, and so, and then there's a few other people up the chain. And so because there's so many individuals who have the title driver, that brings the average down close to where this guy is. That's one way to think of it. Another way to think of it is we don't care about the number of bodies. We care about the different roles, the different jobs. So there's driver. We're just going to simplify a little. There's driver. There's organ. There's call center person. There's leader. Except that. Do we think of it as like that? Because then you start to think, all right, the average would be the call center people, and then you have all these people at the bottom, and they are substantially less culpable. But if each of those counts in some like a scoring mechanism, then that average comes down close to them. Which is the right way to think about it?
So based on this court's case law and its citations approvingly to the Ninth Circuit's discussion of this in more depth, I think it's clear the answer is the former. So the Ninth Circuit has called it like a mathematical average, which of course does take into account like how many people. But I think the key point is that if we do it the second way, really what you're doing is averaging like the top guy and the bottom guy, or maybe three guys, the top guy, the mid guy, and the bottom guy. But the court's been very clear, we need to take the average of all the participants, all likely participants, never saying we just average, we just need to sort of come up with a range of culpability and then we strike in the middle. What we're doing is we're taking an average of everybody, which takes into account who they are.
What's the last part of the test doing versus the average one? So you have this average concept, and then you have, and you must be less culpable than most other people in participants, what is that doing? If your idea of average is right, then what's that last part doing?
Well, I think it's asking a separate question. So you could imagine someone who, so say for example, I think the government did make that argument here as sort of as an harmlessness argument. So say for example, the court didn't agree that he's substantially, not substantially less culpable than the average. The average is a call center guy or something like that. He independently needs to meet the second part of the test because that's what the court has said, it's conjunctive. And there it says you have to show that you are less culpable than most other participants, and most meaning, I think, at least half. And so he doesn't meet that either. So you could have someone who meets the first part but not the second part, or vice versa. So the way it's written, you just have to meet both.
What weight would the because at least there's two statements that opposing counsel has pointed out in the brief that the government said in one, yeah, it would be a very close call, and then the other one, we agree, he's less culpable than, I forget what the woman's name was, Miss Ava Rivera, and then the other statement was, it's another characterization by the government. What weight would that have to the analysis, because it's sort of like, I would say, admissions perhaps from the government.
So I think if you look at, the government put forth a continuum of culpability. So like the, I guess you do the universe and that's step two. So the government said, and did, I think you consider it admission or a concession, or didn't dispute that he's less culpable than 10 other people out of 22 people. And we didn't dispute that at all. We said he's among this cohort of drivers, that they're the lowest level of this group that's charged, or group that's involved, are drivers, and we agreed with that also, and that he's among that group, and that group is that group made up more than half of the overall group of people, and that if the court accepts that 3B1.2 has some numerical aspects to it, which I think it does, he can't qualify. And so that's the end of the analysis. But we didn't dispute, like, he's among the drivers and the drivers are less culpable than, like, you know, the stash house guy or whatever. I think that was all undisputed.
So, counsel, because of the numerical aspects of the rule, and I think the problems courts have had applying it, let's move to 2D1.1, because obviously the commission is recognizing those problems and saying this isn't working the way that we intended. And I would appreciate your response to opposing counsel's position, which is that if we were to accept the district court's interpretation on those two key principles, the 2D1.1 wouldn't really be adding anything, because people who were doing single transaction drug sales for little or no money, in her view, must have qualified even under the numerical intricacies of 3B1.2. So I'm just curious about your response to that, because it clearly was the commission's goal to expand the use of the minor role participant reductions, that it was the courts weren't getting it right. It was too complicated. It wasn't working when somebody wasn't substantially below the average, especially if it's a small enterprise, et cetera. So can you just sort of respond to the thrust of that argument that it's got to be doing something, and perhaps the district court's interpretation didn't actually allow it to do what it was intended?
So I think as a technical matter, that's not correct. So if you had, generally speaking, I think the commission's looking at how 3B1.2 operates. And the idea is, if you're a lower level guy in a very bottom heavy organization, so the it's just a lot of like low level runners, or we've got tons of blind mules working for our organization. None of them are like doing, you know, anything other than being blind mules, but there's like 20 of them or something. If you are doing a numerical test, which courts have interpreted 3B1.2 to be, those people could not qualify either. So it's not that it's doing no work. I don't think that's possible, that they're even at the bottom of sort of that pyramid, those people would still not qualify under the numerical test. So there's absolutely still work being done. I don't think anything the district court said would remove that. And of course, there's also the aspect of it in terms of being motivated by intimate relationship, et cetera, which I don't think 3B1.2 takes any account of. So motivation is also built into it in a way that the original rule wouldn't have covered. And the government views what the court did and what it said it was doing is, I'm doing a totality analysis. I'm reading this example as one thing. It's distributing controlled substances in user-level quantities for little or no monetary compensation. And then just looking through, you know, the facts of the case, because the guideline says it's heavily dependent on the facts of the case. It says further that even if you meet the strict terms of the example, it's only generally warranted, it's not always required. So it's just, it's something that the court needs to think about sort of in a factual way. And that's what the court did. It's looking at the idea that these are not like low-level runners running back and forth with one like user bag at a time. They have this whole day's supply. And it's not like one or two user levels at a time, or even 10 or 20. I mean, he was arrested with 53 grams, may I finish? 53 grams of fentanyl, where the evidence showed, you know, they're selling usually 1 or 2 grams at a time, so it's a significant quantity. And furthermore, that absent contrary evidence, which the government pointed out he didn't provide, people who are working for this like a business, which is what the court said he was doing, they don't do that for negligible compensation. You're being compensated commensurate with the risk, and he's not taking on low-level runner risk. 53 grams of fentanyl is already a 5-year mandatory minimum if he's running.
So what was the evidence of the compensation in the case?
There was no evidence.
Makes sense, but
right, there was no evidence. So the government said on page 164 of the joint appendix explicitly, there is no evidence that he was distributing controlled substances for little or no monetary compensation. And he, after that, did not come forward with any more evidence.
Counsel, what about, and I don't know how this came into the record, but I believe it was in your opposing counsel's brief that one of the participants talked about generally getting about $400 a day. And tell me if I'm misremembering the number, but it was something like that. And so there was no reason to think that he was earning any more than that.
I think the participant he's referring to was not one of the drivers. So it was someone else who was distributing, but not in the same position as him. And it came in, I think, because there were some wiretaps that were sort of in the global memo about the conduct, like we recited certain wiretap statements. So there's a statement that talks about that person.
Who was higher in the organization?
I believe, well, he would have been making less than that. I think the idea is that person, I'd have to go back and check, was talking about how much they would be making, like, for the distribution aspect. So not necessarily my total compensation for everything I do is $400. But he also just didn't put in any evidence. Like, he knows, presumably, how much he made. And the government came out explicitly and told the district court, he's not given us any evidence of how much he made. And he still didn't do it. And I think the court can surmise he didn't do it because he didn't think it would help his case. It would have been very easy for him to put in an affidavit or just assert, like, it was $200 each time. And he just hasn't given us the information.
Let me ask you this. Do you think, as I asked opposing counsel, if we sort of look at the critical legal question in front of us, is it really the district court's interpretation that it you just don't qualify under 2D1.1 user level distribution if you've got more than 2 users worth of drugs or 3 users worth of drugs, because you just referred to that as well.
Right. So I think that's definitely not what the court said. So the court made the comment about user level, you know, earlier in the back and forth with counsel. But when the court actually sort of set out and made its ruling, it's talking about the whole picture, including the little or no monetary compensation motivation aspect. That's where she talked about the business model. They're working for it like a business. So I think to take that in isolation is not consistent with the record. And furthermore, I think when you look at what the purpose of this example is, it's to identify a low-level trafficking function. That's what the example is for. So it doesn't make sense to sort of read terms in that separate from sort of what we're trying to achieve and whether this is sort of comparably low-level to what we think the commission is getting
at
there.
What does the government think the commission means by a low-level trafficking function? If this defendant doesn't qualify, who do you think would qualify?
Well, I think, for example, like a low-level runners who are running, you know, they take a delivery, make the delivery, take that amount of money, bring it back. Like those people, I think you'd usually refer to as runners. I don't think you'd refer to what he was doing as a runner. He just had too much at a time. So he just takes a huge quantity and just spends all day distributing it. It's not the same thing, and it's not the same level of risk.
It's very challenging, and that's why I'm trying to get somebody to tell me how we review it, because these are nuances of how a drug organization works. I can run back and forth to you and the quantity would add up over the day, or I can have it in the car all at once and drive around. These are business models that one drug organization chooses over another, but they're not that different. But the district court drew a line somewhere. How do we analyze that in this new rule, this new guideline? I mean, this is what I don't really understand.
I think the standard review here is abuse of discretion. And then I think if the court had said, I interpret this to mean if you have more than one user level quantity, we catch you with 2, you're out. And had said, I'm making a categorical determination based on how I read this language, then that could be reviewed as just a straight legal error that drove the analysis. And if the court says that's wrong, then it's wrong. But the court here explicitly said, I understand this to be extremely fact-dependent. I am doing a totality of the circumstances analysis. I'm looking at all of this. And she talked about many facts in terms of how this organization operated. So I think that puts this straight into like a mixed fact law determination. And it's not just a straight legal question, because at no time did the court say, because you didn't do this, because, you know, you're the girlfriend of a drug dealer, you never get it. I mean, she never said that about it. She just said, on the totality, I feel like the gist of what the level is getting at is like these kinds of people, and I see what you did, and I don't think that qualifies. So I think that's essentially what the district court ruled.
Counsel, let me just ask you one other thing, and I'm not going to try to read out all the different subsections here because then it's too many letters and numbers. But basically, in the critical language, when they lay out the new rule, It just the answer that you gave me earlier when you were talking about the runner with just 1 or 2 user level drug quantities at a time, it seems like that would be what little I is talking about when they refer to a courier running errands, etc. But it then in 2I says quite clearly that it's still appropriate to give this reduction when you're not just a courier and you've got these other low-level trafficking functions such as distribution, et cetera. So I'm just, I just want to push back that your example really seems to fall under the first exception, and there's a second exception that clearly anticipates that folks beyond the runners should qualify as well.
So I think when you look at the text in the minimal role sort of version of this, courier, as I understand it, in the drug trafficking context, is meaning people who are transporting. So it is just fundamentally different than the people distributing. So it's someone who's like taking some drugs from point A to point B, but not actually distributing them to like buyers. So I think of that as a different type of role entirely. And then running errands, I think there it's not using the term runner like a drug runner. It's running errands sort of for the group, like pick up some.
I understand. Yeah. The way that it's phrased is the low among the lowest level of drug trafficking functions, such as, and then it gives a list of examples. And then there's supposed to be a level above that, not the lowest level,
right?
But that still qualifies for the reduction. So that's why I'm asking you, wouldn't the example that you gave really be a better example for the lowest level versus the slightly higher level that the commission clearly envisioned would still qualify?
I don't think so. So the lowest level is looking at people like lookouts who don't even touch the drugs. So, you know, go stand on the corner, make sure the police isn't there. They use that as an example. Couriers, and a lot of drug organizations use blind mules, so they don't even really know what they're carrying. So, you know, people who transport may not be in the same sort of level of culpability at all as the people who are actually like involved in getting these drugs out. And then I think running errands, again, there are people who sort of run errands for a drug organization, but that's not the same as actually distributing the drugs. So I think the word distributing used in the minor role example is getting at people now who distribute the drugs. And that's in contrast to the minimal role, which is not doesn't talk about distributing at all.
Counsel, let me ask you one last question. The district judge issued a variance after she calculated the guideline. Did she explain why the variance was granted, or?
She touched on a lot of factors, so she not on one factor, but I do note that she did discuss some of the things he argued unsuccessfully in support of the minor role reduction as a basis for her downward variance. So I don't think she said it's just that, but it was certainly tied to some of those factors that he had raised with respect to the minus two. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
Please reintroduce yourself on the record. You have a 2-minute rebuttal.
Chrissy DeMasso for Mr. Vizcaino. I just want to start with a broad principle and then move to a narrow thing about the compensation. I do want to say that I do think it is really important that the government does agree that he is performing a lower level function in the context of this organization. I think that is really critical here. But
is that only critical to 3B1.2? When we think about 2D1.1, that's not about this organization. That's about the kind of drug participant you are as a general matter, right? Or am I wrong about that?
I think that the organization, there's still room for the organization to matter in 2D1.1. It's just that it takes the numbers out of it. To the extent numbers apply, which I disagree. Like I think that 3B1.2 is better read to be about balancing levels of culpability rather than about numbers of people in
that's clearly
roles.
Within the organization, whatever the crime that we're talking
right.
about.
Right. So 2D1.1, you know, takes the number question out of it. Like, are we, you know, is he barred because there are seven people above him, or does it matter that they dismissed two of these or charged less or whatever it is? But I think that 2D1.1 still has room to look at this organization versus another. I don't know why it would sort of like eliminate it off of the...
Well, it uses language in the offense. It's generally warranted of the defendant's primary function in the offense.
Right,
was
which I do think would... It ties it back to what actually happened. I think that's all right. But if I could just, I wanted to correct a few things about compensation. So the government and Mr. Vizcaino filed their sentencing memos at the same time. In his sentencing memorandum, Mr. Vizcaino says, as the government well knows, he was paid, but he was paid little for this. We're looking at a drug trafficking organization that made $15,000 to $20,000 a day. Not him, but the organization. And both 3B1.2 and 2D1.1, especially 3B1.2, actually make this distinction about profiting from the organization versus being paid for a task. And so, he was paid for a task because he needed a job to support his family. And if I could just correct one more thing before I... the individual who said that about the $400, that was Mr. Vizcaino's brother's wife. She had been a driver for the Cuello Reynoso organization. And when she is talking about starting up her own distribution organization, she's saying, oh, if we made $400 a day, that would be more than what I'm making as a driver. So I just wanted to...
One more question. Mm-hmm. 3B1.2, the font, not the average participant, but less culpable than most other participants. What would the evidence have been that could have ever established that in this case?
So I have a number of thoughts about this sort of most piece with whether it's numerical. Is that what you're getting at?
Yes, yes.
Okay. I think one thing that makes most not be numerical is if you look at the minimal participant language that's in the same section, it talks about among the least culpable. Oddly, that seems easier to meet than, right? It should be harder to get a 4-level reduction than it is to get a 2-level reduction.
That one's the plainly less culpable, right?
It's saying among the least culpable. And so I think that you could easily say that if we're sort of talking general language, that Mr. Vizcaino, there's an argument that he is among the least culpable. And I think that's because you have to kind of look at the whole application note together. And they are thinking about sort of these groupings of people and these roles. And so if you think about the drivers as sort of a widgets, right? I mean, they're interchangeable to the organization. They don't care who's doing it. They just care that someone is. And so the drivers collectively are less culpable than most other participants in this organization. Similarly, if you look at one driver on one given day, the people he's interacting with, he is less culpable than most. So I do think that if you're going to read all of the application notes together, sort of sneaking in this numerical problem that doesn't apply to minimal, only applies to minor, which should be, you know, easier to get, doesn't make any sense. So it needs to be read as a whole in this sort of, we're making a common sense judgment about levels of culpability.
Anything else?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel, and Ms. Damaso. I know you brought a very special 8-year-old guest who's been very attentive and well-behaved, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in this case.